They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Dear Fairfax, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining us today from all the way from California is an old friend, Tyler Birding. Tyler is an attorney. He represents associations. He is, I do believe, a member of CAI. But he's one of the few people who will call a spade a spade, and for that I really appreciate having you here, Tyler. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Sue.
We're going to be talking today a little bit about affordability. I mean, one of the reasons we have all of these associations is supposedly to provide affordability and to give local municipalities a bypass on the tax dollars, right?
Well, that's why we have multifamily housing that has been sold as opposed to rented. We've always had multifamily housing, but up until, say, 40 years ago, it was largely rental housing, apartment houses. We all know the apartment house model. It's very familiar. Everybody rents their apartment. The landlord maintains the building, and the landlord owns the building. And, you know, 40 years ago or so, most states passed condominium acts, creating the ability for developers to build what were essentially apartment houses, but instead of renting or leasing the individual apartments, they were able to sell them. And instead of the landlord maintaining the building and the common areas, they created homeowners associations to do that and delegated that responsibility to a homeowners association to which all of the individual buyers of those individual apartments or condos were members and provided the funding to the association so that it could go ahead and do the work it had to do. They're nonprofit corporations, and they are essentially the members are each have a share in that corporation. They're not shareholders, but they're members. In any case, that was the original concept, and then we're talking about attached apartment house style developments, as well as those that some people call townhouses, which is really more of an architectural style, but they're attached properties where there's only one level or two levels and nobody lives on top of anybody else. That when they're stacked like that, they're usually condos, and when they're attached side by side, they're usually something else. But the same maintenance issues arise because even in townhouse developments, associations are usually delegated responsibility for exterior maintenance at least. And of course, in a condominium project, the association is responsible for all maintenance, including structural issues, foundation, soil issues, and all those sorts of things. So you've now delegated, instead of a landlord, you've now delegated that responsibility to a owner's association, and that's principally staffed by volunteers, board members, who then retain appropriate professionals to carry out the obligations that to maintain and repair.
And how well is that working, Tyler?
Well,
now we get to the heart of the matter, right?
Let's just say there's a fundamental flaw in the business model.
Yeah.
And it's not one that anybody really could foresee, and I'm not sure that very many people really understand it now. But the flaw is this. When you look to a group of individuals who have disparate interests and goals in for their own personal piece of that real estate, it is very difficult to reach consensus on what should be done, how much should be spent, and how often the building should be maintained and repaired. And when I say it's difficult, it's not hard for the board of directors to get that kind of direction from appropriate professionals, contractors, building inspectors, whatever. What's hard is reaching consensus as to how much money the individual owner should contribute on a monthly or an annual basis to fund those projects. And you can say, well, if the board is in charge and it's got professionals telling them what needs to be done, why don't they just assess the owners for the amount of money that takes? Well, they have, and it depends on the state, different states have different limits on the board's authority. Some have no limits. But you have political issues involved, which are huge, because everybody that lives there is not in the same financial condition as everybody else. There's people who have maybe they have the means to spend the money on the assessments, and then there are people who don't, depending on how much it is. Most people go into these projects when they buy in. They believe that if they pay their monthly assessment that they understand is usually disclosed at the beginning of when they buy in, that everything will be fine. And they'll be able to maintain and repair the property, they being the board or the owners, with the amount of their monthly assessment, whatever it is, $200, $300, $500, $600, $800 a month, whatever it is, that's what they need if they want. And when they look at that project, and they're analyzing whether they can afford it. We're talking about affordability. Can they afford it? Is there cost of ownership within their budget for housing? They look at mortgage payments, tax payments, property tax payments, insurance costs, and homeowner association dues. All of that gets added up, and they say, my monthly outlay would be X. And if it's X, I can afford it. If it's X plus $500 a month, I probably can't afford it. So they, when they go and look at the potential for buying into a condo, they add up these various dollar amounts for these items, and they come up with an affordability. We call it an affordability index. If it's within their budget, they think they can afford. They figure they can afford to buy it and own it. But there's a major misconception there, and that is that the monthly assessment that is disclosed to them at the time they buy their property, and this doesn't matter whether it's a new, brand new project or one that's 35 years old, same problem. If they assume, most people assume, that's all it'll ever be. And yes, I can afford it. What happens is that those monthly assessments, and for different reasons, are often artificially low. And they're artificially low for any number of reasons, but primarily they're low because the owners are able to set the assessments at the level they feel comfortable paying instead of what might be necessary. How are they able to do this? Don't we have state laws that say we have you have to assess, you have to assess your owners so you can maintain the building at a certain level? Yes, we do. California has it. It is even a mandatory statute. The board shall assess as necessary to maintain properly. Shall. That's not discretionary. That's like you must do it. It's a term in the law that is a requirement. But if the assessment levels get to a certain height where they're beginning to get major political kickback from the owners because the owners aren't happy with the raising assessments, which is very typical, what does the board do? Does it plow ahead notwithstanding that? Sometimes, but most of the time, no. most of the time they recognize the political opposition, and the way it comes out, in most cases, they will keep the assessments at a certain level that meets the expectations of the majority of the owners, regardless of what else they might be being told in terms of from their accountants, from their managers, from their contractors. How can they do it? Even though we have mandatory funding requirements in the certain statutes in certain states, there's no state oversight. Nobody, or city or county or anything else, nobody is going in and making sure that the law is being followed and that the assessments are being raised even to keep up with the cost of living. That's the fundamental flaw. We have a mandatory assessment obligation, but we have no government oversight to be sure that it's being carried out. And if it was, assessments would typically would rise in the typical association 5, 4, 5, 10% a year. Many, many associations keep their association assessments level for years and years and years. So not only are they not keeping up, they're not keeping up with inflation, but not only that, they're not investigating the buildings well enough to understand what's really has to be maintained over time. So the flaw, as I said, the flaw in the business model is basically a system of voluntary taxation, to use taxation as opposed to assessment. It is analogous to any taxation that we have, state taxes, federal income tax. If we allowed people to decide for themselves how much tax they wanted to pay, what would happen? We'd be grossly underfunded.
Well, I would think that people would pay what they felt they were getting a value for. You've highlighted one problem, but I had a manager on a few weeks ago, and one of the issues we talked about was reserve studies and coming up with a plan. In other words, planning for replacement and putting aside a certain amount of money. And I know that we have reserve specialists who this is all they do, is they go into an association, they examine and inspect the places and decide what it will what the lifespan is, what it will cost down the road, and then you plan on putting aside so much money.
Yes.
Sometimes some people feel that that money is it's not very safe because, as you know, we've had a tremendous amount of embezzlement. And when you have a big pot of money sitting there with no state oversight, no homeowner oversight, that money tends to disappear quite often. So you resort to special assessments, and that's when you end up with people who get into financial problems because they cannot afford the special assessments. They weren't planning on it. They lose their homes. I mean, it just snowballs, and you know all of the problems, and so do most of my listeners. So I'm not going to go into all of those. But it would seem to me that everybody would have the same interest in making sure that we don't get to that point. We don't get to the point where we need special assessments. We don't get to the point where we're so desperately, where everything's falling down around our ears, which in some associations they are.
Yes, they are. And let me back up just a little bit. First of all, I appreciate that there has been, there have been any number of reports of board members or managers taking off with money, embezzling money. We see them in the blogs, we see them in the newspapers at mm-hmm. times. But I will tell you that the amount of money lost through that particular circumstance pales in comparison with the money that is never collected in the first place to match the obligation that the association eventually finds it has. The fact is, we're not collecting sufficient funds, whether by regular assessments or by contributions to reserves, to stay even with the deterioration of the building over time. That is the primary reason that we find these projects to be underfunded. We run studies on reserves. It's about, well, every couple of years, I, with a local accountant here, I'm a CPA in California, we run studies in 1,000 associations. They are underfunded by probably as much as 50% on the average. Mm-hmm. That underfunding hasn't been because the money was there and went out the door. That underfunding is there because it never came in the door in the first place for several different important reasons. And the main reason is that the reserve studies that are done are based, at least in California and I think in most other states, are based on an inadequate statute that requires only that reserve studies be done for components that are visible and accessible by someone walking around looking at the buildings. And the damage that we're discovering in older associations, and in fact in a lot of new ones, can't be seen just walking around looking at it from the outside. So the reserve study statutes themselves, certainly in California and I know in many other states, start out with the premise that you can adequately reserve for future expenses without understanding what's going on in the interior of the walls and the other structural portions of the building. And that's simply not true. You can't know that until you look at them a lot closer than they're looking at them. I don't blame the reserve study people. They're following the dictates of the statute. They go in and offer to do a reserve study that complies with the law, and they do. The problem is the law doesn't require them to go far enough, and they miss things that eventually add substantially to the cost of renovating or reconstructing these buildings. And that follows on the heels of, even if they're funding their reserves properly for the stuff they know about, which they don't often, they don't even do that. As I said, most reserves that exist in associations for just the things they know about are 50% underfunded. Okay. So what's left when you come time to replace or repair those buildings and you've only got 50% of the amount of money you need or less, where do you go for it? Where do you get it?
You're on the Commons, and we're talking to Tyler Birding from California. Tyler, you have an absolutely excellent blog called Condo Issues. Would you give us your the URL for your Condo Issues?
It's condoissues.blogspot.com.
And I was there last night, and I found the survey that you were talking about, and I was reading this going, good for you, Tyler. You wrote an article back in May of 2013, so it's a little over a year old now, and it's Condos Still Short of Funds. I think you asked some really, really good questions, and I see where you came up with things that were underfunded, associations that were underfunded, and you actually looked at thousands of associations. One thing I did notice, though, is when you look at it, and you look in 1993, which is when you check that out, about 20% of the assessments went to administrative and, I guess, probably management and administrative, but by 2012, almost 20 years later, that had gone up to 27%. So there's an increase, I mean, a certain chunk of your assessments, there's a percentage increase. And I've noticed that in my own association, where we started off with a much lower percent of the budget going to management companies, but somehow that percentage has increased and increased and increased, so the percentage has grown tremendously. So we're not talking dollars and cents. You know, we're talking about a percentage of the big pie. If you're collecting 100%, so there's more going to admin and less to maintenance and reserves.
Well, you don't know for sure, because admin could include operating expenses to bring in other people that are now necessary to do repairs and things, contractors and things like that. A lot of that is paid out of operating and not out of reserves. when you're doing it on a ad hoc basis. I don't know. The other thing is the totals, which should have risen over the years to keep up with inflation, especially the reserve component, have not risen to keep up with inflation. But the admin expenses, because they're paid under contracts that are renegotiated every year with people like managers and landscapers and accountants and all of those do get the impact of inflation because the contractor, the vendor, is going to raise his price to include an inflationary factor. But if you're not raising your entire budget to keep up with inflation, then those portions of the budget that are reflecting inflationary costs are going to rise as a percentage of everything else.
In my association, and it's a really old one, and I don't know if they still do that. It's the assessments are tied to the CPI, so you start with at ground zero with X number of dollars, and then if the CPI goes up, whatever percentage the CPI goes up, then you are required, or you may raise the assessments without going to the homeowners for a vote.
Yeah,
and that's part of it. So I think in at least that way we've kept up with inflation. We haven't had a special assessment in all the years I've been there.
You see, that's not, and that's not true in every state. In California, there is no mandatory inflationary increase. It is completely voluntary to the boards as to how much they raise the assessments on an annual basis. I don't mean statutorily voluntary, but in practice, it's voluntary. And in practice, they are not raising assessments adequately to stay up with inflation. And those statistics that you're referring to from my article are all California statistics,
yeah,
by the way.
No, there's nothing in the Virginia statute to tie to tie increases to the CPI. That's in my governing documents in the covenants. So the developer put that in right at the very beginning, back in the late 1960s when he wrote those, 68, 69, that, you know, we're starting with X number of dollars, and you can raise it by the increase in the CPI increase.
I would like to see a statutory requirement in every state that would raise assessments to at least keep up with inflation. The serious shortfalls in the budgets, however, aren't in the operating expenses. Operating expenses are the last things to not be funded. You have to pay for your fire insurance. You have to pay for your water bill. You have to pay for your electric bill for the common areas. And frankly, you have to pay for management, professional management, because most boards are not going to commit the time necessary to manage a large project on their own. It's just not possible for them to do it and also keep up with their work lives. So the operating budgets in the operating expenses will always be funded first. When they run out of money or where the assessments won't cover everything, it's usually always the reserves that the money is taken from in order to fund operating. The reserves are, let's put it differently, the reserves are the last thing funded. If you don't have enough money, you fund operating first, and then you put whatever you got left into reserves.
But if you have a plan, then fund that. Like, for instance, if you've got, you know, you're going to have to redo the streets, and you know that it's X number of dollars, and you know that the estimated lifespan of the streets are 20 years, so you figure it out. And I think if there's enough openness, I mean, you talk about state oversight. Quite often when you have homeowners go in and ask to look at the books and records, they're told, hey, you can't do that. That's, you know, why do you want to know? That's a secret. And there's no state oversight to go in and say, well, the law says that you have to be transparent, yet why are you withholding the books and records? Because people have an interest in doing that. You know,
I know that exists, but in California, we have a very strict statute. And I can tell you that, at least in my state, when somebody comes and asks for the records that the statute allows them to have, and it's almost everything except for executive session minutes and some things that are very, very narrowly defined, people get it. And whether, you know, if you've got a board that is holding out on something the statute requires them to provide, and the owner makes a demand and the board refuses, the association could be liable for attorney's fees to go after it. They know that. And that's when we are representing associations and the demand for records comes in, we tell the association, comply. Assuming they even have a reason not to give it to them, and some board members may be hyper cautious, and there are owners who have their own agendas of why they want things, but nevertheless they're entitled to them. The law says they're entitled to them, and they should get them. And if they don't get them, the association could be liable for the attorney's fees of that individual that come after the board to do it. And I get that not everybody wants to go hire a lawyer to go that far, but I think that let's go back to what you said about the reserve plan.
Yeah.
In California, we call it a reserve study, and in many other states, it's the
right.
same thing.
Right.
And it does take those components that we have that were put into the reserve study or into the reserve program by the developer originally, roads, roofs, paint, lands, tree removal, whatever. And, and the associations will follow those guidelines. And in California, that's all they're responsible for doing until they discover that a component has a service life left in it of less than 30 years. And once they discover that, then that component also has to be included in the list of things that they're reserving to replace or repair. And they do reserve studies. They put them out. They have the dollars that are required, and it gets put into the budget. But if you're not assessing monthly enough to cover operating expenses and the appropriate contribution to reserves, the reserves are the last thing funded. That's why the study that we do every couple of years shows reserves to be 50% underfunded, because they're not putting enough money away on a monthly basis to fully fund them. It's very, very simple, and the concept. Why aren't they doing it? Because the owners have whatever interests of their own, and people have long-term interests, they have short-term interests. People with short-term interests that live in those kind of associations don't see any reason to put away money for a roof 20 years from now that they'll never see. So they have a resistance to raising assessments. They want to sell the unit. They don't want the assessment to be so high that no buyers will qualify. That's the same concept that developers have when they put these unit places on the market for the first time. They can't raise the assessments to a level that won't qualify the buyers that they're looking for. So what happens is that assessments remain, and I'll say it again, artificially low. They are below what they should be to adequately fund the reserves for the things they know about. And it's because the boards can do that, can listen to the demands of the owners not to raise assessments, even though their professionals are saying you need to raise it 5, 10, 15, or 20% in order to stay even with your reserve requirements. That's what our study shows. And that is just because there's no oversight. There's nothing that prevents the board from ignoring the law, if you want, and doing what they feel like the owners will approve of. No volunteer owner wants to get into a giant hassle with his neighbors. It's uncomfortable. And you're sitting on those boards, and the owners come in and are complaining bitterly about a 5% raise in the assessments. Your natural inclination is not to fight it. Okay, fine, we'll just leave it the way it is. It's easier. So that's the fundamental problem. We have the owners themselves deciding for themselves what it's going to take to properly maintain the association in the face of information and data that says it should be more.
I think one of the big problems we have is communication, or the lack of communication, and also transparency. Because if everything is out, I think, back when I was on the board, we devote an entire meeting to just going over the budget
and everybody would have a four-page summary at, you know, last year's, the projected, what we did, and all of that. And so they could see where, you know, what we were collecting, what we were doing. And we always raised it according to the CPI, whether we needed it or not. That practice kind of stopped. I think once we went from having a regular manager who was not trained to be an association manager, to an association manager where, oh, the owners don't really need to do this. You don't need to do that. So all of a sudden, instead of the board and a group of homeowners sitting down and working out the budget and going over it at a meeting, all of a sudden it's the manager who did it, and here it is, take it or leave it type of thing, with no real time spent, no, you know, here's what we did. Yeah, you had a few people who were not happy, but overall you didn't have all of the nastiness, because it was much more open, much more transparent. And like I said, we devoted a whole meeting, 2, 3, 4, however many hours it took, to answering questions and going over everything, and they got everything. And there was less resistance to it.
Well, let me say where I think this ends up if, you know, something doesn't change. I have examples now coming online of older associations. When I say older, I'm talking 30, 40 years old, that have reached basically the end of their service life. Now you say, how could that be? These projects have infinite life, don't they? We just have to keep funding them on a monthly basis and they'll be around forever. And you have some older associations, mostly co-ops in big cities, that have been around for 100 years, this style of living. And you certainly have apartment houses that have been around for 100 years, well-maintained in upscale areas where people will put the money into them to keep them properly maintained. But the average association run by a volunteer board and professional property managers will put the information out there, but the owners do not see the intrinsic value in funding that budget with enough money to continue to maintain that project indefinitely. So it eventually runs out of money to properly maintain it, and when that happens, the deferred maintenance that starts 20 years before, because they don't have enough money to keep up with it, or they don't know it's even that things are even happening that are causing damage to the buildings, which is a very big problem. You have this gradual deterioration of the building and a gradual underfunding of the building to keep up with it, to the point where you can't bridge the gap. You cannot bridge the gap. The bank won't lend you any more money. You can't get a special assessment out of the owners that you need to bridge the gap. And we've seen examples of associations going after $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a unit special assessments.
Oh, I've seen over 100.
Or over 100. And unless you're in a very upscale area with high intrinsic value in the building, owners will not be able to afford that, and they will not approve it, and they won't be able to pay it. So what happens then to the building? We've seen examples of what happens. What happens is portions of the building become so deteriorated that the building essentially becomes uninhabitable. The city or county or local jurisdiction will come out and say, you can't live here with those balconies in that kind of shape because they're dangerous. Or those entry structures, those staircases, are so badly rotted and you can't continue to prop them up with 2x4s. You either get them fixed or we're going to red tag your building. And if they can't afford to get them fixed, and often that's becoming increasingly the case, the building gets red tagged, the owners can't live there anymore, and the value goes down to zero. And it just sits there. And I see it happening now in a dozen or so projects right in my area. I know that it's happened in other cities on the East Coast and in places like Detroit and other big cities. are in the suburbs where you have these low-rise wood frame structures that are not properly maintained, and it gets to the end of the road, and the dollar, the funding gap gets so big, the owners can't bridge the gap, and the place is essentially obsolete and valueless. That's where it ends up.
So basically, an association does not protect property values, and I think that's what you're saying. And my question, though, is why are we building such shoddy stuff? I mean, I look around, right around where I am sitting right now doing this show, they are building stuff. And one of them will be on your ad, by the way, on the promo. But, Tyler, these things are going up in a matter of weeks. High rises.
Let me take that part in just a second. Let me follow up with something you said. Homeowners associations are actually designed to protect property values by having central maintenance, centrally planned and administered maintenance and repair. That's part of their governing documents. That's part of their essential, that's part of their essential genetic code, if you will. They're designed to do that. The problem is the flaw I mentioned a while back.
Yeah.
We haven't provided for mandatory funding that's enforceable or overseen by the local government agencies. So that wonderful plan that we've built in to properly maintain these buildings in a way that anybody can tell them how to do it, but when the funding is not adequate, they won't do it, and there's no enforcement of that. My general feeling about these projects is that what we probably have done by moving from pure rental projects, and most condos are not built any differently than your average apartment house. They are just apartment houses that have now sold the living space as opposed to renting or leasing it. But the structure is almost exactly the same.
Well, they've gotten a lot cheaper. And there's no, at least here in Virginia, the county doesn't really do a whole lot of inspecting anymore. They've washed their hands. It's privately owned. We're not going to get involved in this. And they just leave it. The developer's going to cut costs. And a lot of the stuff is prefab, and you can watch it. You can literally watch these things. There's one right from the parking lot that you can see, this huge, huge thing.
Sure.
Looks like toothpicks that's wrapped with paper and cardboard and plastic.
I agree with you, and let me make a statement here. I think at a certain level of pricing, but you cannot go, let me put it differently, you cannot go below a certain level of pricing and still sell units. If you're going to build that kind of low-budget housing, you cannot then put the maintenance and repair of it into the hands of the owners.
I agree with you 150%.
Those should be rental apartments, not owned apartments.
I agree.
There is a level below which you cannot go and expect that building to survive. Sustainability of these buildings is what I've been preaching for 20 years. And I see that the low level, and I'm talking about low quality, the quality that you build to sell at a very low price or below a certain price point, you can't, is not sustainable. For all the reasons we've been saying this morning.
There's a series of townhouses behind me, right where I'm sitting right now, that started at $700,000. What's a low price? I mean, it's just shoddy construction.
It depends on the neighborhood, and it depends on the area as to what, you know, in California, there are entry-level condos that start in the $500,000-$600,000. It depends on the area. You can't look at a specific price point and apply it universally. But whatever it takes, if you can't build it in a way that is sustainable by owners, you shouldn't sell it. You should rent it and leave the investor owners of that building responsible for its maintenance over the long term. Why? Because they've got their money in the building. They will maintain it as well as need be in order to have that building survive. Why? Because it's their cash flow. They're going to do it. It's professionally done. Most big apartment complexes have building engineers and people that are that know what to do. And I'm not saying, listen, I'm not saying all landlords are professional and do a good job. Many of them don't.
No.
But in concept, you can't sell a building to people that can't afford to maintain and repair it over time.
So this affordability, trying to put everybody, I mean, there was a point where we tried to put everybody into a home, owning a home. Even Habitat for Humanity was building homes that were so shoddily built and right. turning it over to a group, turning it over to the members, the homeowners, to maintain streets and stuff like that. It just boggles my mind. I mean, is it a surprise that we're sitting here looking at all this mess?
Well, I'm not surprised.
I'm not either.
I've been litigating those poorly constructed buildings for 40 years. And it is the fact that when a developer is going to sell that building, he knows what price point he can sell it for that will qualify the market that he's looking, a market of buyers that he's looking to sell to.
Right.
And in order to build to a low price point, he has to cut corners. Now that's just the economics of the industry. Now you add to that periods of high demand, like we had prior to the last recession, and we're starting to get in now, they can sell anything they can build. They can't find enough trained carpenters and plumbers and laborers to build them properly. So they get their, and they will cut corners in order to get the building up and get it on the market while the market's hot. And there's just not enough trained people around to build them properly. And they'll cut corners with materials, whatever they can get.
Yes.
And basically, Shu, we spend most of our time doing quality control for buildings that were built 4 or 5 years ago and are beginning to come undone. And we have to go back in and figure out how to get them some money so they can make some repairs to them.
Let's go back to the shoddy construction. Who's responsible for that? Why are they allowed to build that shoddy stuff, and why are they allowed to sell it? Is there no adult supervision anywhere?
The building departments do not have the funding. Here we go with funding again.
Here we
do not have the funding to have enough inspectors to inspect for quality control. They inspect for code compliance, but I can tell you, a building that is 100% or substantially to code can still have shoddy construction in the sense of things that deteriorate quickly, because the building inspector will only look at portions of the components. He isn't looking at every piece of building paper that's wrapped around that building, whether it's lapped properly, whether the other materials are put on properly, whether it's going to be watertight or too watertight so that it rots from the inside because of condensation. They're not looking at any of that. They don't have time to look at it. And we're allowing these things to go up with a minimum of investigation inspection.
So what's the answer, Tyler? What's the answer? What are we going to do about it?
And this is not very politically correct, I would
think. Oh, good.
But I think there is a level below which home ownership is not practical. And rental homes, whether they be single family homes or condos or whatever they are, apartment type style buildings, makes more sense than to put people. Let me give you the most egregious example of taking this to its too far, and that's the condominium conversion from an old apartment house.
That's been your thing since I've known you. You've always sort of sounded the alarm about these things, and because you start off with an old building that doesn't have any maintenance or any reserves there. Yeah.
Now you've taken one that's deteriorated for 30 years, you put a little paint on it, and you're selling it to the lowest income people that could possibly qualify for a loan, and you move them in, and then they've somehow got to figure out how to take all that deferred maintenance and pay for it when it's not in the budget, never was, and never will be. And they should be banned. They should not be allowed to convert old apartment houses into homes for people that can barely afford to buy a home in the first place.
And these people, they're the most vulnerable and the least able to handle them.
And that's the least sustainable type of owned housing, and we're selling it to the people who are most vulnerable. Absolutely right. And I think home ownership is a wonderful thing. I've been very fortunate to own a home almost all of my working life. But we have to be realistic. When we're talking about group maintenance, where we're relying on our neighbors to help us pay for the maintenance of a building and voluntary assessments and all the fundamental flaws in that funding model, at some level, at some price point below, you cannot go below that and try to sell that to that group of homeowners. You should be renting it to them or leasing it to them and having it professionally maintained by investors who have a stake in seeing it done properly. And that's one of the things you could do about it, I suspect.
Your colleagues must love you for being so honest, Tyler.
Well,
you're right. You're right.
I think community associations have a definite place. You have to have an organizational structure when you have people living in beehives or sharing large swaths of common area. You have to have some organizational structure to properly maintain and administer it, because the cities aren't doing it. They've completely dropped out of the picture.
Right.
And they won't do it, and they won't allow things to be built that is going to invest them with more infrastructure to maintain. So we're going to have this form of whatever you want to call it, organization, government, private government, whatever, however you want to term it. We're going to have it because there's nothing going to get built without it under the present, funding of public agencies. But we have to be more sensible about the kinds of projects we apply it to. And the worst construction problems we see are in the ones that are intended for lower-income people. And I think that, although I have to say, we represent a lot of high-end projects as well, and we've seen some pretty expensive flaws in those also. But I think as a class, the worst ones we've seen are those intended, as you said, for the most vulnerable people.
Yeah, they're the least able to afford the so-called affordable housing, and they're stuck with it. And
it's
they
not
lose
affordable.
It's not affordable. It's really and truly not affordable. Tyler, it's a failed experiment, I think. This common ownership or common interest or whatever you want to call it, it's a failed experiment in that it's really not, it doesn't seem to be working. Yes, there are a few that are sustainable. Yes, there are a few that are working. But overall, we seem to have more problems, but we just can't seem to find solutions.
Well, because it's more than an experiment now. We've made a wholesale commitment to this type of organization for housing throughout the United States that is irreversible, because the cities have found that they can raise property taxes by allowing them, and they don't have to, in turn, maintain the infrastructure that they create. It's a formula that it's just too attractive to the municipalities not to let these things happen. I don't see it going away. What we try to do is raise consciousness of the problems of long-term sustainability, so that people will start looking at them earlier and planning for that problem earlier and not waiting till it emerges and there's no money to deal with it. And that's part of what all the stuff I write about is, just to raise consciousness.
Let's give your URL again to your blog.
I'm sorry, say it.
Tyler, give your blog URL again.
Oh, it's my blog's condoissues.blogspot.com. But if you can use condoissues.com, we'll get you there too.
It'll get you there. I think I have it on my website, but I will definitely include it in the promo. But I would highly recommend that you guys go and check it out and look at it, and look at the one about the one that we were just talking about the survey.
Sure. That's back last year.
Yeah, that was done last year.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to do another one in 2015. So we do about every 2 years with this CPA firm that we work with, and just to keep to keep track of the trend. Unfortunately, the trend's getting worse, not better.
It must take quite a bit of work, and it must take timely and expensive to do it.
What, the survey?
Yes.
Oh, well, I mean, it's all relative, I suppose. There's a lot of handwork in processing the data and trying to put it all together, and the firm and I share those expenses, and so we want to see this information and make sure that it is, out there for people to see, although mostly it scares people, and, I'm not sure how much they are going to be able to do about it.
But they need to know. And what about municipalities? I mean, at some point we've heard of associations or buildings or developments or projects or whatever you want to call them literally fall apart, and the local municipality has had to come in and do something because you're leaving a lot of people homeless.
Well, the municipalities don't typically come in and do anything until they reach the point where they become subject to condemnation, or they become subject to, let's put it differently, they become such a health or safety hazard that the municipality has to act. And what they'll come in and do is tag it with a red tag and say, you got to fix it. Unfortunately, by that time, the deterioration has happened over so many years and have been deferred for so long that, again, we're back to that funding gap. Coming up with the money then, as opposed to gradually over a period of years, is almost impossible for some associations. Banks will lend to a point. Owners will accept a special assessment to a point. But once that point is crossed, there's no source of funds. And these buildings will sit until the city kicks the owners out.
And and those are the people I hear from, Tyler. And there's really not a whole lot I can do for them. I don't know what to tell them.
What I try to tell them is basically the truth. I said, you've got to look at your budget. You look at your own home. Let's say you have a single family detached home and your roof begins to leak. Well, if you can't afford to fix that roof because you don't have the income, you'll patch it or you'll do something to get by because people want to maintain the habitability of their homes. But the choice is totally yours. You can either fix it or not fix it, but the consequences accrue to you and you alone.
Right.
You are in a group of homeowners of 200-300 units. That choice is not yours and yours alone, but is shared by people with such disparate interests that consensus often cannot be reached. That probably is the most telling problem that we have, trying to maintain a complex building by committee.
So, but when you get to the point where it's beyond repair and the people who have poured their lives into the building, they're into their units, their little corners, their homeowners, they're out on the street. They've lost everything.
They can't. That very definitely is a possibility. I will tell you one thing we're working on with a couple of our clients is we are trying to partner the homeowners up with developers who will come in, and it doesn't work with all of them. It works with just some, depending on where they're located and how much land they have and all of that. But it is possible to come in and partner up with a developer and redevelop the entire project and preserve owner equity to some extent. The land is worth something. The air rights are worth something. And they're probably worth quite a lot in the right locations. It's very tricky, because you've got ownership shared by 200-300 people. You need a certain vote to get them all to get on board with this. You have to find a developer that's willing to work with that disparate group of individuals. You have to have people like us who kind of understand the dynamic there and can help pull the whole thing together. But we think that ultimately a number of these projects are going to get redeveloped into better, higher, better use projects, And hopefully by doing it right, we can preserve some of the equity of the individual owners and they don't end up with nothing.
Hopefully they'll be better built. Tyler, would you believe we're out of time? Thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you for all of your insights and for being so honest.
Well, that
I really appreciate that, because we do know there are problems. So to be told, oh no, it's not everybody, is not helpful.
Well, thank you again.
Thanks, Tyler. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.